From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Daly City.
Glenmore in Fremont.
East Bay, El Cerrito.
West Oakland.
Richmond, California.
I live in Oakland, California. How you doing?
Coming up, it's the swinginest show we've ever produced. San Francisco is hosting the U.S. Open, where the game's biggest names tee up with unknowns making history.
There's not too many people that say they can have a hole-in-one in the U.S. Open.
Today, we're talking golf. We'll join kids from San Francisco's toughest project playing its most pristine public course.
I'm pretty sure I will die with a club in my hand.
And we'll take a behind-the-scenes tour of the Open hosting Olympic Club.
Give you a little view without Tiger Woods here yet.
Also, we'll meet two legends of the game of golf.
You know, everybody has a chance to try it for it. And that's what makes it great.
Why should you care about golf? You'll find out today on Cross Currents. Golf's national championship has come to San Francisco. Right now, the game's greatest players are teeing up at the Olympic Club, where they'll compete in the U.S. Open in 2 days' time. It's a true celebration of the game, not so much because of the stars who come out, but because of the workaday golfers who have the chance to take the same stage, like Todd Fisher.
So my first shot in the U.S. Open on Saturday morning was a hole-in-one.
We'll hear more about that magical moment later and get inside the ropes of this year's tournament, but first we're going to talk about golf's fundamentals. It's what the First Tee organization is all about. It's a program dedicated to teaching golf, and through golf, building character. There are more than 200 chapters around the nation. San Francisco's was founded by Frank Sandy Tatum in 2004 when he was 83 years old. The Stanford alum is the former head of the United States Golf Association, which runs the U.S. Open. When he was helping launch the First Tee San Francisco, he told me he had a life-changing experience while scouting sites at a local middle school.
And what we've done is we've gone into a middle school in a Visitation Valley. So we found an unused playground in a middle school, Visitation Valley Middle School.
Which is actually right near KALW. It's just, just down the hill from here.
Yeah, yeah. When I was out there looking at that project and analyzing whether we could make it work or not, this delightful guy, Jim Durkee, who's the principal of that school, came out and he said, you know, you guys don't know what you're going to be able to do for these kids. You've got to understand the lives that they live. And I'll give you just one critical example. When they go home on weekends, very, very few of them ever leave their houses because they're afraid. And I looked at that playground and the parts of it where the kids were operating, and there's a non-policeman with them. And I thought to myself, what would my life have been if that had to somehow manage to survive in the kind of environment that these kids have to survive in? So to put it mildly, that was a very serious added stimulus. And what we've done, it's taken us years because of the bureaucratic problems, but we've established a wonderful driving range out there on that playground, unused playground. We've established a sensational chipping area. We've established a wonderful putting green. And Jim Durkee has given us a classroom in the school. So we have basically have a complete facility out there. And within that framework, the First Tee program as a function of every PE program in 9 schools. And when we do that, what we will have done would have been to be able to transform the lives of cumulatively, literally in the thousands of youngsters. And so that's what we're doing, and that's why it matters, and boy, does it matter to me.
That's Sandy Tatum, former president of the United States Golf Association. Tatum believes the First Tee program can change kids' lives. We wanted to see just how much, so we sent KALW's Artem Skonohovs down the street to pay them a visit.
I'm standing outside Visitation Valley Middle School. It's located in the southern part of San Francisco, in one of the poorest residential areas of the city. It's recess, and kids are outside playing. There's the typical activities, football, basketball, but at this school, there's also golf.
How you doing, Manu?
So, Coach Tony.
All right.
Tony Anderson, Visitation Valley's site director, works with 20 to 30 kids every day at the school's golf course. One is a 13-year-old named Faletui Manu.
Yeah, we provide everything that they need to participate. Manu is one of our students who's been with us. He's just walked up getting ready to practice on his little chip here. Nice shot.
This is the First Tee program.
kids from five neighboring schools share the facility here at Viz Valley Middle School. That's about 500 kids throughout the year. There is a putting green and a driving range with a net,
where they learn the basics of golf in terms of how to grip a club, have proper posture, how to swing, whether it's a short swing or full swing.
Oh, that's much better. That's a much better shot.
After learning at the school's golf course, first tee instructors bring the kids to the Glen Eagles golf course at nearby McLaren Park.
Were you going for that hole at the top?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And some of the most dedicated kids have a chance to go across town every Saturday to Harding Park, one of the most prestigious public golf courses in America. It's shortly after 7 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and coach Jaron Jackson is in a van, picking up kids from their homes in Sunnydale. It's the largest housing project in San Francisco, in one of the city's most violent and poorest neighborhoods. First we stop at Manu's house.
So Manu lives right here. That's his mom. That's my first pickup every day. He's been playing about 5-6 months. He loves the game, and he's vastly improving. He's going to be a good player if he keeps it up.
Manu comes out of his home, a converted apartment building that was once a military barracks from World War II. All of the rundown buildings in his neighborhood look the same. The streets are filled with trash. We move a couple of blocks down to pick up some other kids. One of them is late.
We gotta figure out where he lives so we can start knocking on his door. It's half the time he's in there asleep. I thought his mom is usually at work because she never answers the phone. But then she always sends him out.
After several unanswered phone calls, we have to move on. We pick up a kid who's been absent for the last couple of weeks.
Young man, how you feeling, bro? Where you been, man? You gonna quit me? Quit me?
No.
Okay.
This Saturday, Jackson and another first tee coach pick up more kids than usual, about 18. As we drive around, Coach Jackson talks with the kids about golf.
Pick them up, and I had a new set of clubs. I wanted them to see them.
You got a new set?
Yeah, got a new set. Got a whole, almost got a whole new bag, except for my putter.
Finally, after an hour and a half, we arrived at Harding Park Golf Course. It's a sunny day, and the parking lot is full of expensive cars. Jackson and the kids head for the clubhouse, where the first tee has a special classroom. Used golf shirts and caps have been set on the floor in the center of the room. They are donations to the program. Kids are encouraged to choose one or two for themselves.
So now, they used to be on.
After a short update, the kids go to the golf course. Some of them practice their swing. Others are divided into groups of four and take off to play around. Manu grabs his clubs.
My parents say, I mean, it's a good program. They want me to play, you know, first person in my family to play golf. So, you know, they keep saying, go, 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 get better. One day we'll see you in a PGA Tour.
Manu is playing today with 15-year-old Kevin Kirksey.
Good shot, Manu.
Kirksey has been playing golf since he was 9 and recently participated in his first tournament.
The experience was very nerve-wracking, because I wasn't used to the tournament environment. And I think I played pretty good. I mean, for my first tournament. So I don't have any regrets.
Kirksey and Manu hit the ball pretty well and move crisply down the course. It's part of the etiquette of golf, which they are taught in the program. Another 15-year-old on the course, Tariq Turner, says the first tee program develops discipline in all kinds of ways.
They want you to really do good. Instead of just coming out here and whacking a club, they want you to at least be book smart too. So it's a good program.
I ask him about his career aspirations.
Really, honestly, the sport I really want to play is to be a basketball player, but I don't know really, the chances is really slim. So I think I'm just going to really just try to go to a good college and see where it takes me from there.
Turner understands that golf is an expensive game. When he turns 18, greens fees at Harding Park will cost him between $46 and $60. He wants to be able to afford it after he ages out of the first tee program.
Oh yeah, I'll keep on playing. I'm pretty sure I will die with a club in my hand. I love this game. If anybody was trying to take me away from this game, I don't know what I'd do.
Once they develop their skills, they're on the golf course, the next step is how can we make sure that they have a very successful life
Jonathan Lee is program director for First Tee San Francisco.
So that when they choose to continue golf, they have the financial means along with the interest to continue to play golf.
Lee says San Francisco First Tee works directly with about 1,600 kids every year. But most kids don't spend that much time with the program. In fact, Lee says, since the program began in 2004, only about 35 kids that he knows of have stuck with it through the age of 18 and gone on to college. That's not a lot of long-term success stories, but there are some, like Alexandra Wong from St. Ignatius High School.
And Alexandra just won in March the San Francisco City Championship and will be playing golf at Princeton University this upcoming school year, and her twin sister Andrea will be playing on a golf scholarship at UC Davis.
For most kids, though, the first tee is a chance to get outdoors and learn something new about the game and the world they once knew nothing about. In San Francisco, I'm Artem Skonohaus for Cross Currents.
You can learn more about the First Tee program and find out how kids can get involved at kalw.org. Summer session signups are taking place right now. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. Someday a First Tee grad might make the U.S. Open. It's possible. If you're one of the 75 or so best golfers in the world, you can definitely play. But if you're not, you can still try out. Anybody who can prove they can shoot about even par is welcome to take a swing. They just have to make it through three pressure-packed rounds against hundreds of other hopefuls. More than 9,000 golfers tried out for the tournament this year for 76 spots. And some of the people who made it have unlikely stories. Casey Martin was born with a circulatory defect in his leg, but he's a darn good golfer, good enough to play on the PGA Tour if he could ride a cart around the course. The PGA said no, so he sued them under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and he won. Martin had a short career. The only major tournament he ever played in was the 1998 U.S. Open at Olympic. He hasn't played competitively for years, but this year he tried again anyway and qualified. He'll tee it up Thursday. So will Andy Zhang, a Chinese golfer who will become the youngest player in the U.S. Open since World War II. He's 14 years old. 14. Then there's 42-year-old Dennis Miller, not the comedian, the golf director at Mill Creek Golf Course in Ostrander, Ohio, a course that costs $20 a round. In sectional qualifying, Miller found himself in the fourth hole of a playoff, needing to sink a 20-foot putt to play in the U.S. Open. In real time, here's what it sounded like when he hit that putt. It looked good, but he just missed. The ball hung on the lip. And then... it's in the hole. Dennis Miller will play in the U.S. Open. Another 42-year-old, Todd Fisher, tried out, but he wasn't so lucky this time. Fisher's a journeyman. He travels the country from his home in Pleasanton, teaching clinics and giving demonstrations. He plays some professional tournaments, mostly in golf's minor leagues. And until 2000, he'd never played in the U.S. Open.
As a golfer, everybody's dream is probably to play in the U.S. Open.
That year, the 100th Open was taking place at Pebble Beach, down the coast on the Monterey Peninsula.
It was so close to where I grew up, and I've played Pebble Beach hundreds of times, and you know, I just wanted to get back there and play Pebble in the Open.
Fisher's sectional took place at Lake Merced Golf Club in Daly City, and he made it, setting the stage for history.
So Thursday came around. I was just prepared the best I could. I was ready to go, but when you walk around that corner up to the tee from the putting green, then you see all the people, and then it gets kind of nerve-wracking. You know, you don't want to embarrass yourself right off the bat. And I hit a good one off the tee and right in the fairway, got on the green, and I actually think I three-putted my first hole for bogey. So that was not the start I wanted, but I hung in there and did the best I could for that Thursday. And when I finished on Thursday, there was a fog bank came in and they postponed play. So my tee time, the delay was so long that my tee time on Friday was originally at like 1:30, and I teed off at 6:40 p.m. And we played up until the sixth hole. I drove it in the fairways, which is a par five, and they blew the horn for darkness. And when you blow the horn for darkness, you could still play out as long as you want. You could finish the hole. And, you know, I had so many people there watching, and they waited all day to see me tee off. So I hit a good one in the fairway, and I said, I'm going to play this hole out. So I think I hit a 5 wood up. It's a par five. Hit a 5 wood up onto the green to about 3 feet for eagle. And it was almost pitch black when I putted, and I left it short, right in the heart. So that was disappointing, but I made birdie. So then Saturday morning, I had to re-tee it at 6:45 in the morning. On 7, which was my first shot of the day, I had to lead off, and I knocked it in the hole for an ace. So my first shot in the U.S. Open on Saturday morning was a hole-in-one. So that was a good memory. It's funny because of that's what people for years said, hey, you're the guy that made the hole-in-one. You're the guy that made the hole-in-one. And, you know, it's exciting. I had a nice reaction. I think I got play of the day on ESPN, as a matter of fact. So that was kind of nice. But there's not too many people that say they can have a hole-in-one in the U.S. Open. And, you know, it was a big thrill. But when the one thing I remember walking down the fairway to get the ball of the hole was 8 and 9 were so hard that I was like, okay, I'm 2 under on this hole. Now I can bogey 8 and 9 and everything's going to be even Steven. I'll be all ready to go.
That's not a good swing thought.
No.
Todd Fisher. There have been only 41 holes in one in U.S. Open history. Despite his ace, Fisher ended up missing the cut that year by one shot. If he had taken one shot fewer, he would have played over the weekend with a chance to win the Open, which was eventually won by Tiger Woods. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. Pro golf can cost a lot of money. You need sponsors. When Todd Fisher was an aspiring amateur, one of his benefactors was John Abendroth. Abendroth, who briefly played on the PGA Tour himself, is a member of the Olympic Club, where this year's U.S. Open is being contested. It's the nation's oldest athletic club, founded in 1860. Abendroth has been a member since 1967. That's 45 years, and now he's the media chair for the Open. I joined him at the Venerable Space a few weeks ago for a behind-the-scenes look at the Olympic Club as it was being prepared, even transformed, for golf's national championship.
Yeah, welcome to the Olympic Club. We're kind of a bird's-eye view. We're above the 8th green down to our left, and over to the right is the 18th green. This will probably be the most crowded area during the U.S. Open Championship. We've got some maintenance workers that are working on the 7th green here. We've got ESPN's TV studio that's being built. You can see some kind of sound effects. They're building in some plywood around it. A lot of activity out here, and this is actually, we're here on one of the last days that the members are allowed to play the golf course.
All right, so where are we going to go from here, from our perch overlooking the course with Lake Merced beyond that, and if we could see past the hill, we'd be looking at downtown about a little bit to our left here.
Exactly right. Well, we'll take a little ride around the golf course and give you a little view without Tiger Woods here yet, and it'll be easier to move around today without the gallery here as well.
All right, sounds good. Let's go.
The Ocean Golf Course, we have two 18-hole golf courses and a 9-hole golf course here at Olympic, and the Ocean Golf Course is where a lot of the infrastructure is laid out for the championship. We're just driving by the media tent, which is going to have about 1,000 media credentialed people. And this is the 4th fairway here on the Ocean Golf Course, which now looks like a shipyard storage area. You've got containers, you've got trucks. There's gravel laid out. There's a tarp laid on the grass, and then all the roadbed is put on top.
This is practically unbelievable to think we're on a golf course right now, and there are all these temporary trailer facilities and so many stacks of building materials, and we're on a gravel road, and this is actually supposed to be a fairway or something.
Exactly right, and it becomes a choice for the USGA where they have a championship of this size now, that they almost need to pick a facility that either has like a a large fairground next to it, or in this case, another golf course, because it's just that much infrastructure that needs to happen. Over our right here looks like a UPS yard where they'd store all their trucks. Well, this happens to be the merchandise area. The merchandise tent is about 32,000 square feet. Here's a good number for you. Their goal for the week is to sell 100,000 hats. And that's a kind of a wild number. So
100,000 hats, that's, say, $20 a hat, maybe $25 a hat. So that's, I guess it would be $2 million, $2.5 million worth of hats, maybe. So if the hats themselves are worth about $2.5 million, how big overall do you think this operation is dollar-wise? Do you have any idea? It seems like it must be astronomical.
Well, it's actually a number they don't like to talk about, so just imagine it's a pretty strong number. So, yeah.
All right.
So let's take a walk. This is kind of the grand entrance where transportation and parking is really a huge thing. Candlestick Park is the main parking area for the public. They're going to have about 150 buses running at any time that will run from both BART is a major area, as well as from Candlestick, and you'll come in through a grand entrance. So we're right now at the main entrance point, and kind of cool. They don't just have a, you know, kind of an area that you walk through. There's architects who looked at the downtown Olympic Club building, which has been there for over 150 years, and they took some architectural features from that to design the grand entrance.
There are actually masons up there.
Exactly. So you'll have all the folks come through here.
You don't actually often see people building a brick wall, a temporary brick wall.
Yeah, exactly right.
I'm really stunned by these surfaces we're walking on. Right now we're on a plyboard surface, but if you continue down, then it's got some sort of outdoor carpeting.
Yeah.
And it's all perfectly flat, but we're on really hilly ground right now. We're basically on a parkland hillside, but they've built huge flat surfaces for walking areas, and they're all leveled out. That must have taken a lot of engineering.
Yeah, this is a golf hole that we're on where you can see there's a bunker right down here. The third green is right behind us here, and they've literally built these wood platforms to be level rather than having folks, you know, walk, you know, the fairway areas. So
this is incredible. They're building a city.
Well, it's a small city is exactly what it's been referred to, and what's really unique, they've had a great opportunity to hire a lot of local carpenters and other employees here because of, you know, how the economy has been. And they've really gotten some great quality of work. They say higher quality work than they normally would get in other cities. So I think a lot of the temporary workers here have had a great experience and a great job opportunity. So,
how important is that corporate presence here at an event like this?
Well, it's a big presence. The USGA now has what they call partners. There's four corporations, I believe it is, that have official partnerships. And as that year-long partnership goes on, they have the rights to, you know, bring guests to the course. Lexus, for example, is the official vehicle. And they have courtesy cars for all the players. And the way the USGA looks at this is that they have 13 national championships they hold. They have a girls' junior championship, which is actually at Lake Merced this summer. They have a boys' championship. They have a men's senior amateur, a women's senior amateur. So 13 major championships. The U.S. Open is the one that funds all of those things. And research for the game, research for equipment, and is their tagline for the good of the game. So the U.S. Open is a one-week activity that funds all that activity. And they do the handicapping for the entire game of golf and many, many other things. So this whole thing and the corporations and the TV contracts are really what funds all of this. So it's a big deal.
That's John Abendroth. He's a longtime member of the Olympic Club, giving me a tour here of the site where the U.S. Open is about to be played.
Let's see if we can get through this way. Yeah. And then here's the first tee where they will start. It's normally a par 5 that's been converted to a par 4. And it's said that the first six holes are going to be the toughest starting holes in USGA history. And so it'll be a major challenge.
This is kind of a slightly narrow shoot off the tee box because you have some trees that are really framing it. If somebody's a big right-to-left or left-to-right hitter, They might have to think about that.
Yeah, and this is kind of a moderate shoot. I'll show you a couple others that are there's one hole that a couple members have nicknamed the hallway. Very, very narrow, and that's really a feature that the Olympic Club has been known for over the years. We've got a lot of these really grand cypress trees that that border a lot of the holes. So we're now crossing over. This is the second fairway.
And this is just a series of terraces we're looking down here. As we go from number one, which is kind of at the top of the hill for the lake course, and we're crossing fairways and roughs here, we're just going down hills across flat down. It's like rice paddy fields in Thailand or something.
Yeah, yeah, it's really a fun terrain.
There are a lot of porta-potties out here.
Well, with about 35 to 40,000 people out here, porta potties is going to become a kind of a necessity, if you know what I mean. And I'll show you a couple that are kind of the upgraded porta potties that they have for some of the corporate areas. They're sort of the Cadillac, it's sort of a trailer with a couple of restrooms.
The Lexus of porta potties.
There you go, exactly. Yeah, I don't know if the porta potty company is a sponsor, but I bet they'd like to be.
Well, I'm sure they would like to be the provider. I mean, that's a lot of business.
Right, exactly. So we're standing on the 16th hole, and this is the longest golf hole in USJ history, U.S. Open history. It's 670 yards.
And that is a chute we're looking down here for that first shot.
Yeah, this is a real chute here. And this tee was devised fairly late in the game, where normally the hole plays at 609. And then there's another tee marker that was built at about 620 yards. But Mike Davis, who is the executive director of the United States Golf Association and the head of the setup of the Open, he felt he wanted to lengthen this hole because the last five holes are potentially relatively short holes. So he wanted to put a little bit more mustard into this hole. But he wants it to be exciting and fun, and he is more of what they call a player-friendly official. The players like what he's doing, so that's a good thing.
That's John Abendroth, the media chair for this year's U.S. Open, and a longtime member at the Olympic Club, where we just took a tour. The tournament begins in just a couple of days, but the favorites to win are already here in San Francisco. 23-year-old Rory McIlroy is the defending champ. Tiger Woods is this year's favorite. But the Olympic Club has a history of crowning unlikely winners. The U.S. Open was first played here back in 1955. It ended in a playoff between one of the game's greatest legends and a little-known club pro from the Duck Creek Golf Course in Davenport, Iowa. Jack Fleck's victory over Ben Hogan is still considered one of the greatest upsets in golf history. The tournament came back in 1966. The iconic Arnold Palmer took a 7-stroke lead over the lesser-known Billy Casper into the final 9 holes. I reached Casper by phone and asked him to describe that moment.
And so as we walked the 10th tee, I told him, I said, Arnold, I want to finish second. He said, I'll do everything to help you.
Well, through a combination of Casper's clutch putting and Palmer falling apart, the two ended up in a playoff. Casper won the next day in a comeback that shocked the sporting world.
And as we finished the round, he congratulated me, and I put my hand on his shoulder, and as we were walking away from the hole, I said, Arnold, I'm sorry. You know, I felt very, you know, we have such a feeling for our fellow players when something like that happens.
Arnold Palmer never won another major. Billy Casper went on to win 51 PGA tournaments altogether, including the Masters and another U.S. Open. He's now in the World Golf Hall of Fame. Heady stuff for a kid who grew up poor, moving from place to place with parents who weren't around much to take care of him. But Casper found the game of golf, and in the process, he found a gift. I asked him to reflect upon his life in the game.
Well, you know, when I started playing, I had 3 goals. One was winning money, and of course that happened right away. First tournament I played in, I tied for 30th money spot, which was Portland, Oregon, the Western Open, and with 2 other players, and I won $33.33. So I attained that goal. My next goal took about a year, and I finally won it. The Labatt Open in Quebec City, and that was the second goal. The third goal was winning the Open, and I won it in my fourth year on the tour at Wingfoot. And, you know, to be able to achieve those goals which you have set for, you have set for yourself is a very rewarding thing. And to win the Open not once but twice, and I wanted to win it a second time after I'd won it the first time. The first time I was so young I didn't know what was going on hardly, but then to win the way that I won an Olympic club in San Francisco and see how the people changed from Arnold's Army to Billy's converts was an unbelievable experience and something I'll never forget the rest of my life. And it, to be able to accomplish those goals and things that you set in your life is a wonderful thing. And I feel just very blessed and very lucky and very, very, it's been an unbelievable life for me.
That's Billy Casper. His new book, The Big Three and Me, is about golfing in the time of Gary Player, Arnold Palmer, and Jack Nicklaus. You can find my entire hour-long conversation with him as a web exclusive at kalw.org. Billy Casper is the living embodiment of golf's possibilities. It doesn't have to be expensive, or elitist, or exclusive. It can just be something that helps you learn about the world and yourself. If you're young, the opportunities are there, through the first tee program, or maybe just from somebody who lends a hand. And if you're older, you might just need that one lucky shot. You never know where the game might take you. There's just one more thing to take care of in today's show. To close our tour, I asked U.S. Open Media Chair John Abendroth to play the 18th hole at the Olympic Club, where the eyes of the golfing world will be Sunday evening as someone tries to win the 112th National Championship. I told him to pretend that he was tied for the lead.
Well, the big key is get it in the fairway. Don't embarrass myself. My family's here, my friends are here, and I'm just thrilled to be here. So a player has to get all those things out of their mind and just hit a good golf shot and execute the shot.
That was striped, right down the middle.
Yeah, a little right, but that's kind of my shot. I fade the ball just a little bit.
That was good.
And yeah, in good shape there.
While he's walking between shots, I can tell you that you've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Hanna Baba, Zoe Brezhne, Julie Kane, Lila Day, Audrey Dilling, Fatima Duran, Chris Hoff, Artem Skonohovs, Holly J. McDeed, Erica Mu, Nina Nicole, Mary Reese, Stephen Short, and Isaac Silk.
So just to set it up here, we have the clubhouse up on a hillside up to the left above a raised green and a very big set of steep bleachers right behind it, which are going to really provide an amazing view right down this fairway, right down kind of on top of you as you're hitting the second shot.
Yeah, exactly. And you've also got another bleacher up here that's brand new from other years that they've played here. You know, the maintenance guys are going to work here, so why don't we go ahead and hit one.
Get up. Get up.
A little short there.
Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Carshare to provide us an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Carshare is online at citycarshare.org. And thanks to you. We're listener-supported radio.
So what kind of club do you have here?
This is I got a sand wedge here. And hopefully land it about 10 feet on the green and let it roll up.
And you got to pop over the sandy bunker.
Exactly.
You're going to have a fighting shot at a par there.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll hear about the controversy charter schools are bringing to cash-strapped Oakland.
You'll hear parents say, we know the school is not performing according to the official indicators, but it's a good place for my kid. She's happy, right? She used to hate going to school. She loves it now. That should matter.
That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. The band you're hearing now is The Burnt Ones. The San Francisco group channels glam rockers with a nod to the girl groups of the 60s. They're performing on Saturday at the Brick and Mortar Music Hall in the city. Music starts about 8 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Treffney.
A lot of pressure on this putt. John's lining it up. Looks like it's going to go. Which way is it going to go, John?
Well, I think it might break a little right, but I call it pretty straight, and it's slightly downhill. Flags in the back of the green today. Well, runner-up in the open isn't too bad anyway. Did not make that putt. No playoff this year.
But you made that one, and, yeah. You know, a bogey, not too bad at a U.S. Open course.